Welcome everyone to this very special edition of the Fly Culture Podcast, being recorded live at Mallon & Green in Bakewell. Thank you everyone for coming along and supporting this event. Thank you to John and Marie for being the hosts again and having such a wonderful fly shop. I absolutely love it, and we're going to come on to that very, very shortly. I'm going to start with a few confessions first. My bamboo brother, Warren, is going to cringe when he hears this, but I've got to be honest that I have actually been fishing with graphite on the wire. I've had a fantastic time with that. Really, really sorry about that. I've spent some time with Jan as well, and we've had a fantastic time. I think turns out we're from the same neck of the woods. Our backgrounds are exactly the same, so I would say I've got a brother from another mother, but our mothers didn't live a million miles apart anyway, so we may even be related somewhere down the line. But how lucky are you guys and ladies being able to fish these wonderful waters? They've been fantastic. The fishing has been challenging, but really, really good fun. I've learned something from it. I've seen some of the guys, I think Andy and Jeff were fishing the Derwent and came in with frostbite. So I'm kind of pleased that I was standing on the banks of the Wye and fishing there. And I've thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that. This is another season. This has been great for me as well, that my wife informed me that I got my age wrong. So I was a year wrong. So I've got an extra free year of fishing for nothing. So I've already started to enjoy that. I've also enjoyed that, again, I'm getting a little bit older, but I can still thread a fly. So I needed glasses once, actually, didn't I? And very, very briefly, but just the once. So that's a result. So everything's looking very, very good. I christened a new rod. I don't know if you're the same with hats. I'm very, very superstitious about them. And I christened a hat today. I've got a new one on tonight as well. So that'll be christened when we get some fishable water in Devon. I don't know when that's going to be, whether that's going to be May sometime. But again, we've struggled with conditions down in the West Country. So hopefully things will change. This podcast, I'm really looking forward to. We've got some great guests for you to listen to, and hopefully we'll get some questions in. But I wanted to start talking with John and Marie about what they're doing here, because for me, fly culture has been about building communities, and this is a wonderful example of this fly shop and what they've done in building a community, a hub for fly anglers to A, spend some money, but get some information and meet fellow anglers. And that's really, really important to be able to do that. And this is an amazing story, isn't it? Marie, I remember coming, I was saying to the guys earlier that I came in here when it was the Orvis store, and I bought a shirt from you actually a few summers ago now. And it was an amazing leap of faith that both of you have made. Has it been fun?
Oh my God, it's been so much fun, so much stress. But what's made it really wonderful is the absolute loyalty of all our local anglers and, of course, all our visiting anglers as well. Super humbling, but it's made it just a really wonderful experience for John and I and Sam and the whole team.
And John, as a fly angler as well, and Jan was saying, you know, it's wonderful how you're all working together. You've got these wonderful fishing clubs, wonderful fishing, and how he's sort of making this a focal point for anglers to get information as well. Has that been an interesting process and a fun part of that process for you as well?
Yes, it's been great. Well, I know a lot of people in the area anyway, but it's been nice to be somewhere of a centre to pull everybody together and finally sort of make a community of our own. And obviously with the help of Jan and all the other clubs in the area, it's been really, really good and good fun.
And for people who are listening, we've all had the chance, and I came in at lunchtime, and last time I didn't get a chance to have a proper walk around. It's a proper, lovely mix of equipment that people can look at and enjoy if they're in the area, but also online. Do you have web presence as well?
We do have web presence. Sam is the lady behind the scenes, and John and I are under no illusion she's the real boss. She runs all of our social media, all of the online, anything that's back office. Sam's the absolute backbone. We couldn't do without her.
And what's really important about this is that supporting places like this, and I know with the amount of people who are here, you can see you all support it, which is phenomenal. but also having this hub where people can talk, where people can chat and have a good time. And that's really, really important. And supporting these places, if you're buying a few flies, if you need tip it, it's so much easier. I know there are price constraints with us these days, but places like this are so important to the fakebrik of fly fishing. And Bakewell, to me, as somebody who lives 5 hours away, but it strikes me as just about a fishing town in the sense of a river that runs through the centre. You've got the grayling and huge great rainbow trout by the bridge there in the town. And the history as well. Jan was telling me a little bit about the history of the river, the patterns that have come out the river, the people who have fished it over a long period of time. And it continues with places like this. So I will continue to shout about fly shops and the importance of supporting them, importance of standing up for them. And even if you don't live near Bakewell, honestly, trust me, as somebody who is very partial to tackle, this is a wonderful place to have a look. Have a look online. If you're able to have a look, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. There's some nice stuff. Is that process of choosing items to go in the shop, having been an Orvis store previously, was that an interesting process for the both of you to have to go through to say, well, we're going to have these rods, we're going to have these lines? Did it take a lot of time for the two of you to think this through?
Not really, no. We knew, we'd got obviously got an idea of the trade and what other brands that are out there, but we managed to cherry pick what we wanted, I think, didn't we, and put things in that we hope people and the customers wanted. So we've always looked at it from a customer led thing that we want what we get, take the feedback from customers and hopefully fulfill the needs. So
you've definitely done that. So yeah, I'm already eyeing something up over there actually to the right. So there's something else I need as well. But even here, there's great big rod racks, reels that I need to have a closer look at as well. So there's so much stuff. There's waders, the brands that as fly anglers that we love, and we're sport for choice. So long may that continue. And I wanted to talk to Adam as well about the importance of his local fly shop. And I know you live a little way away, but you still come here, don't you? And it's, how far is it in the car for you?
About 2 hours in terms of distance. The fuel bill is quite high. And we get through cars quite quickly. But I think as a shop, really, we've got a load of limbs up here in terms of the Peacock limb, the Leakin District limb, Crestbrook, and all these limbs all centralise around the main organs, which are Malden and Green. And to have this place as a hub, even today we've got members from, you know, loads of different clubs in the areas that otherwise, without a place like this, we wouldn't mix as often. And just to have that for us all to come to and share ideas and share stories and talk about what we actually all enjoy up here in the Peak District is huge, really.
Beautifully put. And that sums it up perfectly. Instead of going on eBay, come to places like this. I can't shout more loudly enough about them. So thank you for that, Adam. Thank you, John, Anne-Marie, Andy Buckley. Let's be having you. So it's early season, and I was lucky enough to fish, as I said, with Jan on the river, and his phone is just extraordinary that it is continuing to ping, ping, ping with information, people saying, where should I be fishing? What should I be doing? And it's been, I get the sense that it's been a challenging start to the season. And fishing water as well, I'm talking about the Wye, of course, which is dry fly water. As a fishing guide, that must be interesting for you, mustn't it, that you're thinking, right, well, there's a little bit of a trickle of this, there's a little trickle of that, but the fish aren't rising. I found I was fishing the water more than anything else. How do you, as a fishing guide, come up with solutions for those problems of early season?
I think you probably nailed it there with the word challenge. It can be a really challenging river. If we're talking about the Wye specifically, with that dry fly only rule, exactly what you've just said, it makes you think more about the water and perhaps less about the bugs. Particularly early season, you maybe think, well, perhaps they're not in that fast water because the water's still cold. They don't want to use the energy. So where are the softer bits? Where's that little back eddy? Where might there be a shallow area where there might be a couple of large darks coming out? All of a sudden, you have to start thinking about different things on the Wye. I've said this quite a few times to clients, and I think people sometimes think it's an excuse or perhaps I'm overblowing it. I think it's the hardest dry fly fishing I've done in the UK. Because of the rule, because of how intricate the river is, it's a complex little river. For a little river, there's a lot more going on than you imagine. I think about times when I fish the chalk streams and things always seem a little bit easier. The Wye's never easy. It's always a challenge. There's always some sort of nonsense that you've got to get through with the Wye to get those fish. But when you get them, as you've experienced in the last few days by the sounds of it, it's so satisfying.
Yeah, for me, not sit fishing the water. And I often think that when I'm fishing the water, certainly at home, that I'm probably searching with a duo or something like that. And that's the wonderful thing about this, that you can't do that. And I said to Jan earlier that I could have, you know, you could sit there and say, well, a duo, and you'd probably pick fish up, which isn't allowed, so we're not going to do it anyway. But that would have found a solution probably more quickly. And I liked the idea that we had to think about it. We changed patterns. We thought, and we came up with ideas, didn't we, that we thought, right, okay, it's walking pace, shallower water, you've got more chance of bringing a fish. So we worked on those things. Is that is that what you're thinking, similar sort of thing? And you're thinking, right, where am I going to find fish? The deeper stuff, they're probably in these conditions not going to come off the deck, are they?
It is exactly that. You start thinking about, particularly in the colder water, how much are these fish going to be willing to move to make that decision to eat a bug? It's got to be worth it. So you can't expect these fish to move a long way across the river or up the river. So it sounds like Jan's probably fed you exactly the right kind of information. It's kind of find something about knee depth, about walking pace, somewhere where they haven't got to work hard, ideally somewhere just down from a riffle with a bit of oxygen, somewhere where you might have a few more bugs coming down. And generally there are fish there. And what we find is, because we can't nymph it, I actually think these are some of the most willing risers that there are in the country. The difficulty is getting quality drifts is also very difficult, so you have to overcome that. But I find, compared to perhaps the Derwent or perhaps the Dove or a couple of the other rivers that we fish locally, they are more willing to take the dry fly on those days where it doesn't seem to be happening.
I know certainly at home there'd be no chance of catching fish on dries right now. Absolutely no. And very often I'm thinking, wow, are there fish in this river? And so we've got that ability. I don't tend to do it so much now. I spend more of my time, I think my heart's probably on the Wye, actually. I spend more time when there's a bit more water with salmon, and then I wait to see. And the Granham, I guess, as we were talking about dates, and it sounds as though they're similar sort of time as we have back home, that the fish are just starting to rise a little bit there. And that's where you start to feel, you as a guide, and I know Granham was my bailout, that I knew that I was starting to get fish up on the surface. And even as a guide, seeing fish rise make a difference, don't they?
Do you know what, it's, Pete, really interesting. This has been a hot topic in one of the sort of WhatsApp chats we've got going in amongst a few guys in the group at the moment. The Granham's one of those hatches I sort of dread around here. We get relatively good hatches of them, but I'm convinced they seem to feed on them more subsurface than they do once they break the surface. And again, you end up talking about why might this be? And obviously, with it being a caddis, once they've hatched, once they're above the water, they're quite mobile. And we're still talking about fish here that are in quite cold water. So where they might be willing to chase that quite mobile caddis when the water temperature is 12, 13, 14 degrees in the middle of July, they seem to be not quite so willing to chase them when the water temperature is 7s, 8s, 9s in April. The big one for us is the large darks, and that's the one that the fish seem to really key on as a sort of over-the-top rise, as a surface rise. So you know on the Wye, as soon as you've got a trickle of large darks at this time of year, you're in business.
I must admit, I caught one on a jingler yesterday, so I felt rather pleased with myself. Again, we don't have them rising to large darks. We get a nice hatch, but we don't tend to get them rising to them. So it's interesting what you said about the Granham as well. Much smarter people like Paul Gaskell and Don Staziker are here somewhere. And oh, there's Paul, I can see him at the back. And for me, I always believed that the Granham ascended very, very quickly, so they're not on the surface for any real period of time. Is that what the conclusion of your conversations were as well?
Quite possibly. It's more the sort of mobility of the fly. You know, most caddis, they don't kind of get off nicely like an olive does. They're not quite as stable in flight and tend to bounce around a little bit more. Just sort of feel like maybe it's something that the fish aren't as willing to chase while the metabolic rate is still low. Whereas that smaller hatch of olives, and it generally is a smaller hatch of large darks as opposed to the Granham, they seem to be more willing to feed on. So sort of the natural conclusion I came to there, right or wrong, is that perhaps they're just not willing to chase while they're quite this cold.
And you made some really interesting points about the casting. And one of the things I noticed, particularly standing on the bank, was the importance of the drift, which is always important. But even from the standing on the bank standpoint, that it becomes even more so, doesn't it? That you need to have plenty of slackline casts in your armory. Is that something that you're getting your clients used to and thinking about pretty much from the off?
These are drift picky fish. They really are probably the most drift picky fish that I've fished for. And I think being on the bank, you know, there's always going to be a little bit of line hanging off the rod tip that might not be there. Usually you're often having to cast over one, if not two different feed lines to get to that fish on the far side. So yeah, all of a sudden the longer leaders, the longer tippets, slackline casts, little wiggles, parachutes and stuff like that. It's worth having those in the armory because there are going to be fish that you're going to have to cover. And you might not be able to get to them with any of the drifts.
Yeah, I know there's a fish yesterday that I thought I saw move, and I was trying to, it was in between, and there was a soft piece of water in between two fast flows below the bridge, and I was putting so much slack in, I could barely reach the drift because there was so much. So I had to figure that out, and it took some time to do that. But they're really, really important things. Which casts do you tend to favour, and which one will you get your guests using?
So often it's the parachute. Just because most people, I think, find that the easiest, it is, in essence, a bad cast. It's the cast you might have made before you had a casting lesson. So throw it up there, let it bounce back at you, kind of dump it down a little bit. I tend to go down the slightly longer leader route because then you don't have to make a wiggly cast or do anything weird with the rod arc. It just doesn't turn over quite as well. And that in itself provides you often with enough slack to be able to make the drift. So rather than get too techie with the cast, which, you know, when you've only got 4 hours with someone, that's not a lot of time to learn a new cast. Rather than get too techie with that on those really difficult fish, all of a sudden we're at 18-foot leader and it just sort of collapses at the end and then you get your drift anyway.
Nice tip. And I found that I was fishing a much longer leader than I normally do. I suppose part of it is because I wasn't standing in the river as well. Partly as well that I was with Jan as well, so he had a look at things as well. But those little things can make a hell of a difference, can't they?
I remember when Ivy and I first started fishing here, and we started with the 12-foot leaders straight through 6X and stuff like that, and we were picking up fish, but you just walked away and thought, I'm leaving fish behind here. Like, there's stuff that's not working. Because it's such a complex river, because it's so intricate, because there are so many feed lines, and because you've always got the issue of being from the bank, you've got to have these tricks in your armory. If you want to catch more fish, if you want to catch those bigger fish particularly, you've got to have a few tricks under your belt.
What would you say for people casting those longer leaders? Where do you think there's the sweet spot or the comfortable place for anglers to approach? And what sort of strength are you looking at as well?
In terms of length, we're talking there, Pete?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to vary hugely depending on the wind conditions on the day. There are days when we might go back to a 12-foot leader if it's absolutely howling, and everyone in here will know it does on the Y. Sometimes you'll drop back because you've still got to be able to control it. We start about 15, 16 foot of stock. We might go out a bit if the conditions are good, or if we've got to get loads of slack, we might drop back a little bit if it's a fish that's closer, or if it's, you know, during mayfly season when all of a sudden drift isn't quite so much of an issue even up here. But about 15, 16 feet, I find most people with a little bit of encouragement can actually turn over quite a lot more comfortably than they realize. I think the difficulty people have, and I'll run this past you, so I've stopped telling people on a guided day how long the leader is. Because if you told someone they were on a 17-foot leader, all of a sudden they would start trying to cast it like it's a 17-foot leader, and that's where the problems came in. Whereas what I found is if you just let someone crack on, they'll catch a couple of fish, and about an hour in or an hour and a half in, they'll go, this is a long leader. Yeah, it's 17, 18 feet. And they go, oh, I can't cast that. So it's, well, you have done for the last 2 hours beautifully, so don't think about it. But the second people start thinking about that longer leader, that's when grip tightens, blood pressure goes up, gets a bit more difficult then.
I was going to say about psychological, and that's a wonderful way to think about that and not trick people, but not tell them. That's a great tip. And one of the things I often say, and I know there's instructors here and my hero instructors here that I'm going to be speaking with very, very shortly, but practicing the cast as well. And I talk about it so often that if you practice that cast, life becomes so much easier. And with this long winter that we'd had, I'd not had much of a chance to get out and make a few casts. But even 5 or 10 minutes before you know that you're going to be going fishing, let's say in 2 or 3 days' time, when that rod feels familiar, certainly to me at least, then life becomes a whole lot easier, so that you're not concentrating on the cast, you're concentrating on the fish. And that does pay dividends. I'll keep talking about it for many years to come, but I think it's worth mentioning, isn't it, that practice? And I guess you're doing the same, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And for a lot of people, going out into a field and practicing that way, it might be a bit time constrictive, or they might not have a field, it might just feel a bit weird. One thing that I find I do actually is, if I am covering a fish in a spot and maybe I spook it or miss it or lose it, I might just spend an extra 5 minutes just continuing to make that cast, knowing that the fish is gone. I'm not going to catch it, because all of a sudden now there isn't the sort of focus on, I've got to catch this fish. It's, can I make that cast again? Can I make that cast again that way? Can I make it a bit easier? Can I maybe make the drift a bit shorter or a bit longer? So even if you haven't got time to practice on the grass, or, you know, life's difficult for everyone, it's very busy, you can find ways to practice while you're out on the water. And it is so important. Like you say, the more familiar you are with that kit, the easier the next shot's going to be.
And it's interesting what you're saying about the psychological side of things, because I'm sure you'll know this well, and other guides here will know it, that never mention there's a low branch. Don't never say get it under the branch, because the moment that you say that, I know it's going in the branch. So not mentioning those things. And it is, we talk many times on this podcast about this approach to the fishing, that you think about the cast that you're going to make before you make it, so that you're not hoping it goes in there. Find that solution. If it's canting the rod over a little bit, coming off the other shoulder, just changing things just a little bit, suddenly make life a whole lot easier, don't they?
It was really interesting that day that we did on the Lathkill last year, because we hadn't fished together up until that moment. It turned out we're both quite big visualizers. So both of us did the same thing. We would find a fish, and the first thing I do is I'll put the rod into the non-casting hand, and I'll just make the cast a couple of times with the right hand, just to let it feel familiar. Would that be about right? Because obviously you're not hitting the tree behind you, because you're not casting the fly line, or the tree in front of you is not a danger. Does this feel familiar? Does that feel about right? And then 4 or 5 times, have I worked this out? Have I got the wind right? And then you swap the rod over. And I find that, for me, that's quite a big thing. It's something that sort of grew into my fishing without me realizing. It was actually I'd be years ago that pointed it out, that I would find a fish and the first thing I'd do is just start waving my right hand around. it looks a bit weird, but actually for me, it worked really well. It might not work for everyone, but just having an idea in your head of what that's going to look like before you've made the cast, I find makes the cast so much easier.
Makes a lot of sense. I know we've spoken over winter and the weather's been a pain in the backside, to say the least, for you. I'd just like to say, keep doing what you're doing, man. You're doing it so well. You're keeping that standard so high, and you're making a living out of something that's incredibly difficult to make a living out of, and you're doing it. So you have my utmost love and respect for that. So just keep doing what you're doing, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andy. Right, well, before we move on, I'd like to shout out a few people as well that are doing great stuff. Damo, you're living the dream nets. They're available in the shop. They're absolutely fantastic. So keep doing what you're doing there. Paul Gaskell, I've mentioned. He's been on the podcast very, very recently. He has a website and he has a article-based correspondence that he sends out to you for minimal cost. It is so full of information. We're really lucky we've got people like Paul here tonight, and Don as well, right in front of me. Sorry, Don. I thought you tried to escape while you could. That are doing wonderful stuff. And these are the people I'm sort of, well, that fly kind of work there and that one. These guys are going into it in such depth that I still think, and Don and I were talking earlier, I think in a number of years to come, people will say, yes, that's what these guys were talking about. So I can't recommend them highly enough. Don and Peter's book, I'm sure most of the people here have bought it. If you haven't, please buy it, because it will make you a better fly angler. Steve Shorrock started fly tying. He's in the store tying as well now and has a business, and his flies are available in the store now as well. Support these sorts of people. IB's been mentioned. Just keep doing what you are doing. You're so good for fishing. People like you are promoting fishing in such a positive, great way. Keep doing it. I know the weather's been miserable. You've had the knitting needles out. Put those back. Get that fly rod out and get doing what you're doing, because it's great. So apologies if I've missed somebody, but there's just so many wonderful people in fly fishing that we need to be shouting about. So if we can keep doing that, that would be wonderful. Now, I'm going to call Carl Humphreys up. Yes. You can run, but you can't hide. Carl is my hero. And when I started on the instructor journey a number of years ago, it was 20 plus years ago at an advanced level, that Carl assessed me. And I've been in awe of him ever since, because this was the person who said I could cast a little bit. And I was so nervous. And I think if I didn't take it on the day that I took it, I'd have bottled it. And I don't know, you probably won't remember, because you've put many people on this journey. There was a kid throwing stones. Yeah. It was at Kenmore, and there was a kid. And I said to the kid, and I had to turn around and say, look, I'm taking an exam. I'm nervous enough. Can you stop throwing stones for a bit? So he left me alone, and I still didn't know whether I'd passed. And we were walking back over the bridge at Kenmore, and Carl just looked at me and said, you pissed it. So I was really pleased. Thankfully, that meant I'd passed. And that was a very, very special moment for me. Yeah. But what he's done for fishing, he's been bringing kids into fishing for many, many years now. 45 years. He's been involved with the Prince Albert Angling Club. He's just done, you can talk to him about anywhere that you fish, and I'll guarantee you he's been there or he knows something about it. But we put the world to rights. We could have done a podcast just sitting down before we came tonight. But we were talking about fishing generally. And I wanted, because you've been around and so deeply immersed, you run wonderful fly fishing locations, and I know John and I were talking earlier about one of the places that Carl used to run, and it was like this. It was a hub, and people would go there and not even fish. They'd go up there to be abused by Carl verbally, I hasten to add. But he's done so much for our pastime, and I just wanted to get a sense of what you felt of how fly fishing is looking to you right now.
I think it's always going to be healthy. When you look at the biometrics within the room, we're all of an age group that's, no disrespect to anybody, but we're not young, are we? You know, and that's sort of when you, no, come on guys, you know, I'm 65, and if I do a fly tying demo, I'm generally the youngest in the room. You know, what happened to these? And for me, I think probably now more people come into fly fishing 55 plus with a disposable income, you know, wife's been under, you know, get under my feet sort of thing, you know, and that's where I see it going. Maybe we need to target or bring in. We only have 2% of ladies in fly fishing. That's terrible, you know, at the end of the day. 6 heaviest fish ever caught in the UK, 7 are all ladies. You know, you're great at it at the end of it. I would love to see more ladies out there having a go. It's a lot easier. The kids, you know, they probably start off course fishing and then migrate into fly fishing as they get a little bit older. You know, but people just want rewards straight away nowadays. Instant rewards, especially kids. They don't want to go through the apprenticeship of fishing, which is a bit sad. All that technology's out there now. Where do we go with it? I don't have the answers. You know, the project to run with Get Hooked on Fishing, which Malin and Green support with us as well, I think in the last 22 years, we've put 45,000 students to an accreditation. You know, so they are out there. And what you hope is that they drift back into it when university life and family and the pub and girls get past there and things. So that would be my dream, you know. All the organisations I'd love under one roof. You know, make us stronger. We get let down constantly because we're fragmented. You know, if we had one solid body, and I know the Angling Trust are there to do things, but all clubs, you know, we should be talking to one another. We should be working with one another. You know, we've all got pollution incidents. We've all got avian predation. We might have canoeing, but we're stronger as a united front. That would be my personal dream after all these years. You know, meeting Pete when I did, it was great. By the way, he flew the exam because we had a casting section in there for accuracy, and every single one was a bull. It was an interesting time that we had at Kenmore, because a deer swam across the river chased by the biggest lurcher I've ever seen in my life, which pulled it down on the bank, and Jim Furnit it on the head with a great big stick. You know, next minute this massive gamekeeper came and I said, well, we've got poachers on site today. The kid throwing bricks. So we had a tough time, but trust me, it was well deserved. It wasn't a giveaway, folks.
That's very kind. I will send you the money via PayPal very shortly. Thank you for that. Yeah. What I wondered as well, from a fishing perspective, do you think it is contracting? Do you think it's growing? Because we had this spike in post-COVID, yep, when people were allowed out. That follow-through, we knew the follow-through wouldn't be as big as perhaps we would hope for, but I was talking to companies, Mark Bale out in the States, I was talking to him, he said it was like a river runs through it again out in the US, that people were going out, and whether that has continued through. But as somebody who's been so deeply entrenched in fishing for such a long time, does it feel to you as though there is a contraction, or is it, and the question I've been asked, are we just a group of people doing our thing in a niche pastime, and it's never going to be a mainstream thing that's going to take off in a huge way anyway?
I think mainstream, no. I think we're out there and we're doing it. It's always going to be around there. You know, angling and fishing are two different things. Angling was the sport factor which came in from court. Fishing was about game fish and fishing for the table. You know, things might have changed slightly on that format. But over the years, now I think we're still as strong as ever. And, you know, look at people here tonight, you know, supporting Mellon and Green. You know, what a time to open a shop. You know, there's a recession out there. I still have to travel miles for a fly fishing shop. Most places are actually closing. These guys open. And look at this. You know, the quality will still remain long after the price is forgotten. So come and support them. That's one thing. I don't buy off the internet. I can't tell anything by waggling, you know, go and have a go. I want to talk to them. I want to get the advice. There's so many different things, you know, and you're all here and we'll all have different ideas. Years ago, when I wanted to be an instructor, I saw two initial people. One was Hugh Fulkes and the other was Peter McKenzie Phelps. And Hugh Fulkes was about learning to manage people on a riverbank because he was absolutely a master at it. And Peter McKenzie Phelps was the casting. And I know Pete Arfield used to use it as much as me, but he did say it to me that the most important distance when casting is the 6 inches between your ears. And that's what you've just said about your casting, what your presentation, your leaders and their advice. But you're only going to get that with hubs like this. You know, the fisheries that was at, whether it have been Westlow, Darnford, Titusworth, all had hubs of anglers. Yeah. And those people are still out there. Everybody's here because you're keen, yeah? You've all caught, you know, fish this big, that big, and that big. I was out with the kid yesterday, lost his mum on Boxing Day. His gran brought him, course fishing, but the smile was that big and the fish was that big. That's where it all starts for me, and that's where the passion is. I still get that tick whether I catch something that big or that big. Not really bothered anymore. I think that competitive thing where I've got to catch the biggest, the most, well, dissipates when you get a bit older. You know, you're quite happy to sit there on the bank and have a butty with your mate and watch the kingfisher come up and down. But that's all a part of it for me. The wildlife, the people, the social side is as much as about casting, as about dressing a fly and being out there. You know, it's great if you tie. You know, but there's quite a bit of pleasure if you tie your fly and your mate catches on it, if he hasn't put it up that overhanging branch. Yeah. So, yeah, there's always going to be fishing for me. It's in my DNA. I think it's in the country's DNA. And what people never, ever say, it's your heritage. It's been here for such a long time. Yeah. We've got fish named by Romans. We've got other species that have been brought here for a food source. It's here. We're not going to go away just because somebody changes it. Rod license sales last year, 735,000 were sold, rod licenses. You think that's disastrous? In the 70s, it was over 3.5 million to 4 million within that time period. Last year, they take a spike. But the argument for me there is everybody buying a rod license? Hands up. I'm doing a hands up. How many of you saw a bailiff in the last 10 years? Great. I need to know where you all fish so I don't go. Right? It's been 25 years since I've seen a bailiff on the pieces of water I fish. 25 years. I've got more chance of seeing Lord Lucan riding Sheargar. Yeah? Maybe they are underfunded, but generally, they're not out there. They haven't got those resources anymore to actually bailiff effectively. And that does worry me. I showed Pitt a load of pictures of salmon that have been illegally poached. When you bring mandatory measures in on migratory fish, it moves people away from the riverbanks. Yet you would have been better off working hand in hand with clubs, riparian owners and anglers. And for me, that's always going to be the biometric of how your river works. It's about partnerships, whether Jan's here working in partnership with her. I'm not here to fall out with nobody, but I would like partnerships. If, you know, resources together, we're way better and bigger. So that's where it would go for me. I think we're probably stronger now because people are more passionate. Yeah, guys, you know, all this happens when you were kids, your toys were so expensive. They just got a little bit more expensive now, haven't they? Yeah. And we're all collectors of, my wife would say, antiquities and crap. You know, but I love my crap. You know, I fish with it all the time. Yeah. And there again, she associates it as a jerk at one end, waiting for a jerk at the other. But there again, I'm not into Louboutin shoes either. So works both ways. You know, for me, just make it fun, guys. It's all about smiling and being there. Be a part of it. You know, seasons. Do we have them anymore? Wet and dry. That's it, really. You know, what would have changed? And I'd like to see things done on avian predation. Clean rivers, pelagic netting stocked. Goes on and on and on, but we can't fight if you're not united. So any club for me that wants to put up a fight and stand its ground gets a big thumbs up. So on behalf of angling community, thank you. Thank you for Malin and Green for being here. Thank you for inviting me and for my little posh friend here. And he is posh. I've been to his house. He's got fruit in a bowl and no one's ill, right? This guy is posh, right? And we're talking somewhere between Scrooge McDuck and Bruce Wayne. Yeah?
We used to be friends. I think that's the first time somebody from Essex has been called posh, so I'll definitely take that. But thank you, mate, very much for those thoughts. And I think you've said some really interesting things about standing up. I think often we talk about social media on here, the ills of it, but that has helped the debate with water and all the other things that we've had to deal with as well. So I think it's great from that point of view. And what you said about having fun, not putting yourself under pressure. Don't, and I've said this a number of times already, don't let social media rule your life. Enjoy it and try not posting something. It's still a good day. I promise you that. And something that Jan said to me this morning, that we were talking about fishing, and I said, you know, if you were a certain person, you could put a duo on and probably catch a fish. And he said, yeah, but you're cheating. You're only cheating yourself as well. And that was a really salient point to me, that it doesn't matter. It's not about catching every fish. It's not catching about the most. It's not the biggest. That doesn't matter. As long as you're enjoying it, and speaking to many of you tonight, you are enjoying it despite frostbite as well, if you thawed out by now, you two guys. But I think that's the key thing. And I think that's where it plays into hubs like this at Malin and Green, that I feel now that I'm amongst my people as well. You feel like I do about fly fishing, and what it means to you means the same to me and many other people. And I think this is the shift that we're starting to see, that it is about a little bit more and enjoying that whole experience on the water, wherever that may be. So long may that continue. Thank you, Carl. We're going to move on now to Don, and we're going to talk a little bit about some technical stuff as well, because there's so much. And at the last recording we did down south, we had Pete Hayes, and he spoke eloquently about what you guys have been looking into. And again, I've said it already, I've said it a number of times before, what you're doing is game changing. I'm the sort of person who says, well, that fly worked, but you guys are giving me a reason why these flies work and the patterns that you're coming up with. What are you thinking about this season? Are there things that you're starting to zero in and you're starting to think in a little bit more detail now, or are you sort of seeing how things are unfold?
Well, I think there's a whole load of things that we're thinking to do this season. We've done a lot of underwater photography. We've done a lot of photography from the bank, looking down at flies as they actually hatch off. What I'm going to try and do this year is looking at a level at the fly. You can use these split lenses so you can see above and below. Great for release shots, but equally good for seeing the emerger and the adult fly at the same time. Got to save up the pocket money a little bit for the housing for the camera, but hopefully that should show us some things we've not seen before. The other exciting thing that's around now, there's actually a macro lens you can get with a 2 foot long probe on. It's waterproof with a ring light on the end, so you can stick it underwater. You can film the nymphs on the rocks and on the weeds. So it's looking at perhaps how some of these creatures hide from the trout. You know, we're always thinking about how they actually come up to the surface, how the trout would intercept them. But lots of these things have survived because they don't do that. Caddis, for instance, you know, hiding amongst the rocks, camouflaging their cases, and the protective coloration of lots of nymphs. Some of the stuff we've done, it shows how they change when they actually emerge. They look more silvered. But we've all seen fish that feed off the bottom and everybody says, oh, they're shrimping. Well, not always they're not. They're taking other things. Now, on a dry fly only water, perhaps we might not be experimenting with that. But I've had times where I've cast a fly and actually let it sink to the bottom and the trout will come over and just take it off the bottom. So the thought that you need motion or some kind of emerging fly is not necessarily true.
And so does that lend itself, does this mean it's going to be videos? Is it going to be a similar sort of book in the making? I guess that's going to take a whole lot more time, but is that what you're thinking? And is this how you and Peter, you know, conversations I've had with people tonight, and Andy and Jan and I were talking about fly behavior before, and I know you and I did as well, and with Paul as well earlier. Does that mean that you're thinking, right, okay, this is going to lend itself to something new for you?
I think when you start taking both video and stills, particularly close-ups, you always see things you didn't expect to see. Many of the things that we put in both the books we wrote were things we didn't even know existed. Peter sort of gave me a set of questions that he wanted to answer with video. And I said, well, everyone we answer, there's going to be four more questions. And it's absolutely proved to be that. But I think the big value of the sort of hub kind of thing we've got here is the interchange of ideas. And listening to Andy talk about the casting, you start to think, yeah, I think that way too. And if enough people are doing that and they're being successful, then hopefully we've got a sort of a group entity, if you like, that we're sort of coming towards some idea of how trout fishing works. Because I started off and I was doing all the clever casts, reach casts and curve casts and wiggle casts. And then I noticed whenever I did one of those, I pulled the leader bolt straight. Got nice wriggles in the line, no wiggles by the fly. So I tend to go for the philosophy that Andy goes for. Nice long leader, dump it in a pile at the bottom. It's a lot easier to do, and it's easier to do accurately, which I, for one, can't do with curve casts. So you can do these things, but actually when you go fishing with some really competent people, you notice they use fairly simple casts that they can do accurately and reproducibly. And sometimes you can be led astray, I think, by some of the clever casting stuff that looks great on a platform at the game fair, but for me doesn't actually perform on the river.
And that's an interesting point you make about the casts and the distance of casts. And many of the guests that I've had on the podcast talk about how close we can get to fish. And that must be something that you notice as well. And that's by function of that, that makes it a much easier cast, a manageable cast as well, doesn't it?
I think I probably fish at about a third of the average distance that I used to. And I had a friend who stopped fishing for 4 or 5 years. When he came back to fish with me on the river, he put out this massive, beautiful, long, straight cast. And my first thought was, why on earth are you doing that? the more water you cover, the more drag you're going to get, the less accurate you're going to be, because obviously any deviation is magnified by casting further. Striking's harder. Seeing what the fish is doing is harder. It all gets worse. You've just got to believe you can get close enough if you do it slowly and stealthily. Certainly, we've actually filmed one or two things. We've got some video of a fish that took 3 feet away from me. I'd stood for an hour and a half without moving in the river. It was rising right next to me. I turned around and filmed it as Peter cast to it. You can get a lot closer to these fish than you think. And we've always been told fine and far off. But what you've got to remember is, when Isaac Walton was telling you that, his line was tied to the rod tip. Fine and far off was about 15 feet, not 60 or 70 feet. And because we buy tackle that will cast a long way, we tend to go and do it. Whether we should is an entirely different thing.
And do you think that's why we're seeing this change in rod action as well, that we're seeing rods that bend that little bit deeper now as well? Because A, from playing a fish perspective as well, they're better, but also there's not that need. We don't need to make Herculean long casts right the way up the river. Do you think it's driven by that perhaps a little bit somewhere down the line?
I think fly rod action was a bit like 0 to 60 on a car, you know, who'd got the one that would cast the farthest, and they were obviously king of the block. But because you've got those rods, they're absolutely useless at close range. They wouldn't load up because you haven't got enough line weight out, unless you overweighted the thing by a massive amount. Now you've got rods that are happy at close range. I think things like Tenkara really open people's eyes, because you couldn't cast farther. You had to put yourself in the right place and do the right approach. And it really changed my view when I fished Tenkara, because I was a fast rod guy. I like to cast a long way. My success rate absolutely skyrocketed when I fished closer.
Can we talk about your drill then? Let's say we're on the Y today. It's early season. It's pretty slow. There's not a lot going on. You see a fish rise. How are you approaching that? What is your thought process through that for people tonight and listeners?
I'd go back to before that, which is the river's up. And it's not just a bigger, faster river. It's a different river, because there'll be a threshold point for a trout where it won't be economic to actually stay in that spot. It'll burn more energy than it will gain. So some of your favourite spots will not hold fish. I mean, Andy summed it up very nicely, looking for walking speed water, knee depth, something that's not too difficult to come up and take, particularly if you're fishing on a dry fly only water. So when I've done that, I spend a lot of time looking before I fish. I don't put a fly on and go and fish with it. I was once asked why I'd put a particular fly on in the car park, and the answer was it stopped the leader dropping through the rings while I walk up the river. But you see people put the car park fly on. As soon as they see a rise, out comes the line and they cast it. They don't stop for a moment to think whether that's the right fly to use, but you see it all the time. We're all guilty of it. So observe more, walk more slowly, and you will see far more fish feeding. I've just written this up actually for a magazine article where the editor asked me to write for 5 things that were most important for river fishing at the start of the season. And none of those 5 things have got anything to do with tackle, rods, reels, lines or flies. It's all to do what goes on with, as Carl said, those 6 inches between your ears. It's also to do with focus, because if you've got relatively few opportunities early in the season, I caught a fish yesterday, it took within less than a second of the fly landing. So if I hadn't shot the line through my fingers and just let it go, never have caught that. As long as that fly's in the water, you've got to be 100% on the money. You can't do that all the time. You need to chill out and have a beer with your mates. But when you're actually fishing, you've got to fish. And so often when you're guiding people, you'll shout strike and they go, what, me? And you think, well, who else is here? And you say strike several times. It is chewing your fly. And you think, are you not looking where I'm looking? Now, some people are so taken up with the fact it's so beautiful and so nice. They're in a sort of nirvana and they aren't focused. And I understand that. But when I get home after a day's fishing, I'm absolutely wrung out. I don't have to walk very far or do anything physical. I am physically tired from using my brain. And if I'm not catching, I'm always thinking, why am I not catching? And it's so easy to just keep doing the same thing again and again and again. It worked last week, or your mate told you it would work, and you're not looking at the evidence that's in front of you. You mentioned little trickles of flies coming off. You're seeing those. But you've got to know where to look and what it looks like. And I think it is that mental aspect of it. The visualization thing that you mentioned, super important. I do the same thing. I don't wave my arm around in the air, but I do a very similar thing in my head. I can see the cast before I do it, to the point where sometimes people say, how did you put the fly there? And I go, I don't know. I looked at where I wanted it to go and it went there. But it's very important, if you're going to practice things, to get stuff out of the way that you don't want to destroy your focus. If you're having to think about how to cast, you're not thinking about how to fish. And that's why the two things conflict. You can't practice casting while you're fishing because you've got the red mist. You want to catch that one. But I think that you need to get stuff consigned to just complete muscle memory. You want it to go there, it goes there. You don't have to think about it. When we're testing rods, what you tend to find is there'll be that rod that you don't have to think. It just does it. And I would say it's like hi-fi. When you had a really good hi-fi, you listen to the music, not the machine. With a really good fly rod, you cast and it just goes where you want it to go. You don't have to drive it. You don't have to think, oh, this is a bit softer than I really like. There'll be a rod for you. And your rod might not be my rod. But you know it when you find it. And sometimes we'll do a test of 10 or 12 and you just do a cast and you go, that's the one. And you hand it to your mate without saying anything. It goes, yeah, that's the one, isn't it? Now, what is it about that feel? And it's that the rod talks to you. It gives you some feedback. And you all know if you've got a favorite rod, you'll make that cast and it won't go out exactly where you thought it was going to. And you'll do something with your left hand or your right hand to make it work because the rod is telling you what's going on. And some rods, to my way of thinking, just don't do that. And it's not necessarily they're fast or slow. They just don't work for me, which is why you've got to come and try them in a shop. Would you buy? Yeah. Well, there's the commercial push, isn't it? Why would you buy a car that you haven't driven? I've done it twice and sold them within a month, including the Renault 5 turbo with an hour and a half's turbo lag. Oh, no, we find people don't want to drive these, sir. You know, most people like them. Well, not me. I would not buy a rod I've not cast. There's absolutely no point at all. And it is a pleasure to have somewhere where you can do that.
You're exactly right, Don, and I'm looking to the left at that rod rack, and there are a number there, and you make such a important point that I might hand you a rod or you might hand me a rod and I may not like it. You've probably got it set up as it should be and I would hope that I've done likewise. And I spend a lot of time, a rod's not going to make you a better angler. And Carl said years ago when he used to do demonstrations, he'd put the rod down and tell it to cast and it wouldn't do anything. And that's dead right. And we spend, I know he will, many of you here will spend a lot of time with a fly line on a rod, then a different one. That feels right. And we had it, you know, I road tested a rod yesterday that I really enjoyed fishing with and I'd spent time with different fly lines. I'd probably be more likely to change a fly line than a rod. Sorry. but that's what I would probably be more inclined to do or try some. And if you come along here and try rods, bring your reel with some different lines. And I'm sure the shop's probably got some that you can try. And it is very subjective, isn't it? It's down to that person, what they like and what they feel. And the important word that you used, I think, was feel. For me, I want to feel the blank. I want to feel what it's doing. And I feel in tune with it a little bit more when it feels correctly set up to me. I guess you're pretty similar, are you, with lines and everything else?
I think sometimes people waggle a rod and it's soft and they go, it's got feel. It's not, it's soft. Feel is that feedback that you know what it's doing. And there are some highly specified rods, very good reputations that I've cast, and I just don't get that feeling. Other people may do. A lot of it is to do with the fly line, though. Certainly when we've been testing them for the magazine, we've found that using a couple of different fly lines, you'll cast one and you'll think, well, this is really indifferent. You put a different line on it, absolutely comes to life. And I think a lot of people just seem to think that weight forwards are just weight forwards. There's weight forwards and double tapers, but you look at the number of different taper variations, and it's actually really difficult looking at the packet to decide what you're getting. They all look roughly the same in those little 3-inch long diagrams. We went and did a rod test. I won't say the manufacturer, very highly reputed rod. Cast it, and I thought, not my money. Put a different line on it, and you go, oh, yeah. And that wasn't overweighting it. That was a subtly different profile from the same manufacturer of lines that on the box look almost identical. And until you've had the chance to do that, and at the shop, we do that. We've got a range of lines in different weights so people can find what works for them. And I think you're right, Pete, changing the line alters the characteristics more than changing the rod quite often. But it's really important to know the range at which people are going to fish as well. You get yourself a sort of a triangle taper type of line with an incredibly long, thin front taper and try loading up your fast rod with 5 feet of that out. Nothing's going to happen. If you're making big long casts or roll casts, it's going to be fantastic. So knowing the use is equally important. So when somebody tells you how great their rod and line combination is, ask them exactly how they use it. But we're rubbish at that, aren't we? Because you see somebody catching, say, on a still water with a fly. Everyone will ask you what fly it is. When was the last time anybody asked you how deep or how fast you were fishing it? It doesn't seem to matter. It's the fly that's magic. No, it's not. It's also the way you're fishing it. So it's important to know the parameters that tackle is going to be used under, I think.
Yeah, some great points there. And my reference point usually is if you're buying a rod, if they do their own fly line, there's a pretty good chance that's going to work really well. And I know the rods you guys work with, Chris and Carl and others as well, that they have their own fly lines. There's a pretty good chance those blanks have been tested on those. So that's usually my first reference point to start with, that if there's something along those lines. You mentioned the triangle taper, and I own one of those once, and I was casting it, and I was out in a field somewhere, and I was casting it. Cool, that's a good one. Pulled it in and cast again. I couldn't make the rod move. The triangle taper somehow shot off and never returned. I've never, ever seen it since. So it may be going around the world still at high speed, but I never found it again. But it came off there.
I think a 75-yard cast counts if you're not attached to it.
It was probably one of the longest casts I have made, certainly. Well, I think we're almost coming up an hour now. I'm not going to apologise that we've mentioned Mallon and Green a number of times and other people as well. I'll keep shouting for our pastime, anything we can do. We were very proud that recently we had a fishing club that were in trouble, and so we put together in a week an auction and we saved them. We've talked about salmon farms. We've talked about many other things from the beginning. We will use fly culture as much as we can to promote and shout about our wonderful pastime. And we're really, really lucky to have it. Where you guys live and where you fish is a wonderful place. Enjoy every moment of it. It's been fabulous being up here. I've loved every second. It's been wonderful to catch up with everyone. This, everyone, has been the Fly Culture Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for everyone for coming along today. It has been wonderful fun. One last thing. John, what is the website address for Mallon and Green?
mallonandgreen.com.
Mallon and Green. It's one of those. Mallonandgreen.co.uk. Thank you, everyone, for coming along. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Fly Culture Podcast. There will never be any charge for these. It's wonderful to talk to people about fishing. I look forward to doing the next episode very, very soon. Thank you for listening to the Fly Culture Podcast.